Okay. So, thank you for reading, ladies. And I have asked Mary Jane to come up and introduce our speaker for this evening. So, thank you, Mary Jane.
My name's Mary Jane. I'm an alcoholic. It's always scary when I walk this way. This is my friend Sharon. Sharon and I met about a year and a half ago. I met Sharon at my home group. She had just moved here and was trying out some new meetings. And we have think alike sometimes, which is scary to people as well. I was making some changes in my life. I was stepping out and doing some different stuff in AA, and Sharon came along on that journey with me, and we've gotten to be good friends. I value her friendship. She works hard in the rooms of AA. She has a strong program. Sometimes when people get sober and stay sober for a while, they just kind of sit, you know, and they're happy there. And I've watched Sharon, she continues to seek God, which is what we're told to do, and she constantly reaches her hand out to newcomers. So I have heard bits and pieces of her story, and I'm excited to hear the rest of it.
I suppose I'll get rid of the gum first. So you always think that the nervousness is going to leave. And so far it hasn't. So my name is Sharon, and I am an alcoholic. And, you know, the only peace that I actually got tonight was the minute that the Serenity Prayer started being said. Because it's like, this is just another meeting. I just happen to be the one up here behind the podium tonight, right? But the Serenity Prayer, anytime I hear that, it's like the signal that I'm with my people. And I know I'm in the rooms, and I know I'm right where I'm supposed to be. So, move the mic. Hello? Y'all can hear me? Okay. So, the one thing I want to do, you know, I'm told, I got to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Okay, that's the purpose of me being here tonight. And the one thing I want to do is try to keep it real. I had not spoken for probably 18 years, I'm guessing, 12, 15, 18 years. And I spoke for the first time after a long time in, about 3 months ago. And I cried through the whole thing. All right. So you have to know that anxiety has been with me all day. So I've got tissue in my pocketbook. So if I start, you know, crying, but we'll get through it. And I do this not because I want to, but because my sponsor told me when you get asked to do something in AA, you always say yes. So my sobriety date is June 6, 1983. And I was, I didn't walk in out of any grace or gratitude or seeking help. I came to the rooms because the law told me that I had to be here. I loved to drink and drive. I thought I was really good drinking and driver somehow, and wouldn't let people take the keys from me and all of that stuff. So, by the grace of God, I didn't kill anybody or myself while I was out there. But I don't know. I think back about, we talk in the rooms about how alcohol is but a symptom of our disease. And when I look back, you know, and I hear different people, different stories, and I hear, you know, some people came from good homes, some people came from bad homes, loving parents, parents that were selfish, I mean, you know, drunken homes, sober homes. I mean, I think we're a mix of all of that. I came from a very normally dysfunctional family. Adult child of an alcoholic, very codependent mother, but they loved us. They loved our family and provided for us. So I never wanted, you know, it wasn't like I was beat every day or, was deprived anything. I had meals, good home, education, and parents who took care of me. But early on, it's like when, you know, you reflect back and you say, tell me about the good times in your life. Those aren't the things I remember. The things I remember are the times when I felt self-conscious, when I felt like everybody was looking at me, or when I was embarrassed or humiliated. I always felt like the odd man out, the odd kid out. I was never, we listened to a speaker Thursday night, that's the third time I've heard her share pieces of her story, and ours is so common because I never felt like I fit anywhere until I got to these rooms. So, having said that, the first time that I popped the top on a tall Budweiser, fresh out of the cooler, and you know how it is, it's wet from the ice, pop it, you hear that sound, and turned it up, it was magic. It was magic. It did for me what I could not do for myself. And it gave me courage. I was bigger, I was smarter, I fit in. I might have even liked myself. I don't know. I thought I could do anything. I certainly thought everybody else would like me or did like me as a result. And that was, I think I was 14 at the time. And from that point forward, I chased that feeling and every drink that I had. But I think as most all of you, if you're the same as me, you never found that feeling again. It was elusive. But I chased it and I chased it and I chased it to the depths of hell. And then fortunately, I found out who I was and what I was, and I ended up here. You know, so the irony in this, and I looked it up online because my memory is kind of bad sometimes, but I drank for only about 6 months legally. Every other drink I ever had, I was not of age. And I can remember I couldn't wait until I was 18. That was the big thing, because I was going to be able to go and buy beer, go to the bar, and not have to worry about, you know, seeing the right bartender to make sure that I could be served drinks and whatnot. Of course, I never seemed to have a problem getting it. But they changed the law. Before I turned 18, so I was right in that age group, and moved it up to 19. I was so pissed I went and got drunk over that, you know. So everything, you know, there was always an excuse, right? Always needed to go get drunk. But my thing was anger, and I don't know. I don't know what I was so angry about. Just angry about life. Throw a big fit, fist fights. I don't know about y'all, but we used to drive around the Dairy Queen. Go uptown, okay, you would go uptown on Friday night, and you drive the circle, and we go through the Dairy Queen, and then, you know, the girls who liked the same boys, we'd all meet in the TGMY parking lot, and then somebody would fight, and everybody's drunk. I mean, that's just the kind of redneck town I grew up in. So I was a beer drinker. And I tried everything. I tried the liquor. The liquor made me throw up, so I didn't drink liquor. Wine was too sweet. Pot made me paranoid. Now, I loved any kind of little pill that would keep me drinking longer, and that's the way I'll leave it. So anything that would enhance my drinking and let me continue. I think one of the important things for me that I really saw once I came in these rooms was that I never drank normally. You know, I hear some people's story where they drank, and they drank for a while, and it was under control, and then they kind of pass through this point of whatever happens, point of no return. But from the very first drink I had, from that first Budweiser I had, I never drank normally. I always drank until I either passed out, blacked out, whatever, and came to. I don't know. So fast forward, all the gore, you know, I was the drunk that would call my mother at 2 o'clock in the morning from the bar and be in the little phone booth there. Down, and I can remember, I was thinking about that today for some reason, being crouched down and crying and just carrying on to her about, you know, how my life sucked, and I don't know why I would call her and do this to her. But, you know, and then we think that we're the ones that are so injured when we get here and need to be loved back into shape when, you know, it's like a wrecking ball throughout the life and all the destruction. So I graduated high school. Somehow I got through, graduated high school. I had the full ride scholarship thing through the grant money that was available at the time. And I thought things would get better, you know, because something else changed. There was an environmental change. So, you know, never thinking that the drinking could be the problem. So up to this point, never tried to stop. And I went to school, went two semesters, or they were quarters back then, and it started interfering with my drinking, quite frankly, so I dropped out. I figured that, you know, college wasn't bringing in money, but the work was bringing in money, so I had to work and drink. And it was during those times that I really started having a lot of bad relationships. I was extremely promiscuous. You know, I thought the sex and booze went hand in hand. Every night was a party. And I did not know where I was going to end up. I usually had to find a car in the morning. Heard somebody tell a story Thursday night. There were times that I woke up in circumstances that I wondered if I had killed somebody. I mean, it was that kind of thing, and I would have to do that backtrack thing. And, you know, the brownouts where you remember vague pieces of it, it was just, it was crazy. I would drink all night long, get back to maybe my apartment. I can remember sitting in the shower and just letting it run and knowing that if I let myself go to sleep, and that's when I would use enhancement, other things, to keep going. If I went to sleep, I'd never wake up, so I would just sit there until I could come to enough to get to work. And that's how I lived my life, and I thought that was normal. I thought that was okay. I mean, obviously it wasn't. I was miserable. I was unhappy. Angry. Had my front teeth knocked out at a bar by some weird guy that I met at a bar that I didn't even know and wanted to go home with him, and I'm in another town. And I see these women who are these stories of women who just disappear. Nobody ever hears from them again. And that should have been me, because that's the kind of lifestyle I live. So, second DUI, let's say this, second arrest for DUI. I should have been arrested many, many, many times, but a small town, they would follow you home, call somebody, that kind of stuff. But twice I actually got charged with a DUI. And so the second one, they took me to jail. And I remember waking up. And the jailer brought me a carton of cigarettes from my parents. And I said, oh, shit. If they're buying me a carton of cigarettes, I'm going to be here for a minute, right? That meant they weren't bailing me out. So, of course, what I didn't know at the time and later learned was that they didn't know, they were desperate. They, you know, had been praying for me and this and that, and somehow they picked up the phone and they reached out to AA, and somebody in AA said, let her sit her ass in jail, and said that's what she needs. So that's what they did. And I got, that was my very first 12 step call that was done on me. And I remember, you know, really, Bill and Martha probably don't know it to this day, but they probably saved my life from that one's 12-step call. And I can remember the jailer came and let me out of the cell, and they let us go into the dining room. And I sat on the table, one of the tables, and they didn't have all the lights on. I could just feel the environment. And they were telling me their experience, strength, and hope, and reaching out to me. And I was so arrogant, so smug. And, you know, I can remember just when they got done, I looked up and I said, you know, I really appreciate you coming down, but I don't have a problem. I don't have a drinking problem. And I believed that. I really believed that. It was everything else, everybody else. It wasn't the alcohol. Alcohol was my solution. So, I don't know, a few days or whatever after that, I went to court again with my arrogance, walked in, judge sitting up there. I'm looking at the judge. And the little jailer lady tried to be so nice to me, and I can remember thinking, you fucking bitch. How dare you? You know, and what had she done? She was doing her job. But that's all I could think of, standing there, just evil eyeing her and thinking how much I hated the judge. Why are you doing this to me? Of course, the judge said, well, we're going to sentence you to 12 months in the state penitentiary. And that didn't even faze me. It just pissed me off, made me mad. And she said, or you can successfully complete a 28-day treatment center. But if you come back to town and you drink again, you're going to have to complete the sentence of the jail prison sentence. And I had the audacity to just stand there and hesitate when she asked me what I wanted to do, as if it was a real big decision to make. And then, you know, just cast it out. Well, I suppose I'll go to this treatment center. You know, I'll make you happy. Oh, God, I just, you know, I look back and I'm like, who was that person? So I went to treatment, and I was, you know, mad the first week. I was always mad. But then there were some cute guys in there, and, you know, they kind of showed me a little bit of attention, and, of course, that was always a way to manipulate. It was probably about the third week, though, that I don't know if it was I started getting wore down. I don't know if I, there was a point that I actually got down on my knees and prayed, and I tried it. And it wasn't just the, okay, get me out of this one, God. But it started to wear on me. And I can remember there was a group down in Bushnell, Florida, that would bring in a meeting every Wednesday night. And those were the AAs. And I can remember we weren't allowed to talk as treatment attendees or whatever, but we were just there to listen. And then after the meeting, they would come and talk with us. And I remembered they were like kind of cool people, and they were friendly, and I liked them. So my experience with AA at that point was pretty good. But by the time they told me I had to release, it was time to go home, then I got scared. Because I knew it's like all of a sudden my safety blanket was going to be gone. I wasn't really ready. I just wanted the pain to stop. I didn't want to stop drinking. I was not convinced at that point that alcohol was the problem. You know, if I could only manage well, if I could only get the right job, if I could only meet the right guy, if my parents would just quit being shit asses and help me and do whatever I need, if, you know. But I went back home, and they armed me with, you know, you had to make the little contact, get the contact of the person back. So I actually called Martha, who was the woman who had 12-stepped me. And I was supposed to make contact with her that Sunday when I got back. Now, what do y'all think I did? So Monday, I remember picking up the phone and I called old people, places, and things, right? I called friends because I'm doing great. I feel great. I feel better. I wanted to share what I had with them, let them know about this marvelous discovery because I knew they were worried about me, right? So like Tuesday night, I went to the bar and I drank Coca-Cola with them. Wednesday night, I did the same thing. Well, Thursday night, I said, you know, I could probably have one and leave. Because I hadn't tried that before, right? But I did, and I left. I had one drink. I was so proud that I could do that. So Friday night, I went and I had two. Or something like that, but a manageable amount. And yeah. So I was so giddy with, I think I have this thing with, I can drink and not do the crazy shit I did. And Sunday night, there was a party at somebody's house. And I went to the party, and I was gonna do my manageable drinking. One of the things that I remember the AAs talking about during the meeting was that if you're not ready for this, it's not gonna work. It's for those who want it, not for those who need it. But one thing for sure, if you come to enough meetings, AA will mess up your drinking. And anytime, you know, that I would share about how things hadn't gotten that bad, you know, that three-letter word yet was always pushed back. And I went, that party was like, I don't know how to explain it except just it was like my whole drinking fast forwarded times 10. It was one of those nights. I remember starting at one point. I remember just craziness, fighting, yelling. I remember just this, you know, pieces of it throughout. Lost clothes somewhere. Lost car again. I mean, but it was, you know, what happens, right? We don't know what's going to happen when we pick up that drink. As long as we don't drink, it's okay. But when we take in that one drink, we don't know what's going to happen. And that's exactly what happened. And when I came to that next morning, I could hear those AAs in my head. That it would get worse, that you never start back from where you started, that it's never gonna get any better from here. You don't get that reprieve. It starts right from where you left off, and boy, did it with a vengeance. And I woke up so scared that morning that I was willing to go to any length to get sober. And I really think that that's when I took my first step. I think that was it. I knew at that point, without a shadow of a doubt, that my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless over alcohol and that if I did not stop drinking, I was going to die. That's all I could think of. And so I picked up the phone and I called somebody that back in Bushnell that I had met and I said, I need help. And that's all I had to say. And in 3 hours, they had somebody drive up there and pick me up from Douglas and take me back to Bushnell. Introduced me to who would become my sponsor. Barbara took me into her house. And I think, you know, we think, whew, some of the risks that we all took. I have nothing in the world to ever think, I mean, it's like if I have for a moment to get ungrateful and I look back at the things that people did for me. Barbara took me in her house. She had two children there too. Let me come in. She made sure I got to meetings. She worked the steps with me. She taught me how to live sober. That's the best way I can say it. She said, do what I do. And that's exactly what I did. If it was laundry day, I did the laundry with her. If it was time to mow the lawn, I went out and helped pick up sticks and do whatever. I mean, I did whatever. And when she had to work, she says, oh no, you're going to a meeting, okay? You had to find a job. You got to pay your way. I mean, those were lessons that I was taught in AA. Don't be a freeloader, right? So, I know this is, I don't know, it's my story though, whatever. So I was 20. I don't know if you've done the math yet, or I guess I didn't really tell you how old I was, but I was 19 when I got sober. And I remember going to the meetings. I joined. Turning Point Group was my first home group, and that's where I got sober. And that's where my family, my AA family was. And we went back and visited that this past summer, and it was really surreal just being back in the place that I actually got sober. And everybody had turned over, and there was only one person there that we remember being there when we were there. But I remember old timers saying things like, oh, I spilled more beer than you ever drank. And, you know, there was the bet, you know, that I wasn't going to make it. And I was scared I wasn't going to make it. I think that, I don't know, if maybe fear kept me coming for a while. But they told me to do 90 and 90, and I did like 93 and 90. I was desperate. It talks about the four horsemen. And I remember, and I didn't really talk a lot about the feelings of what really brought me to where I was, but I can remember hitting that point where I couldn't get drunk, no matter how much I drank, but I couldn't get, it's like, and that feeling of being, you can't go to sleep, you can't do anything, but you're just full of fear. And it's like the world is caving in. I can just remember that. And when if for one moment I think that I could go back out and take another drink, that's all I got to do is remember that feeling. I can remember white knuckling it, driving my car around curves out on those back country roads, and thinking, if I just hold the steering wheel straight, I can end this all because I'll hit that tree. And then I won't be anybody's problem. So it was not all parties. I didn't want to go back to that. And that's the thing that I remembered that they told me when I picked up that white chip. They said, you never have to feel this way again in your life. And I never have felt that way again in my life. Now, I would love to tell you that at 35 years sober, life is grand. Problems stop. It's peaches and sunshine every day. Your husband does exactly what you want him to do. Your children mind. Your work is great. You make all the money in the world you want, and all life's problems are solved. But I think y'all know better than that, right? There's one thing that I know, I kept telling people in my home group after I picked up my year's chip. I'm like, okay, now y'all tell me how this really works. I'm like, come to meetings, read the big book, work the steps, talk to your sponsor, work with other alcoholics. It's like, yeah. I'm doing that, I get that. But tell me the real, you know, I always wanted what was next. And, you know, I found out for many, many years to come, I always wanted what was next. I couldn't be happy with where I'm at. And I think that's another symptom of our craziness, our insanity. But I always wanted, and then of course they would say things like, well, when you get 5 years, you'll get your marbles back, and then it takes 10 years to learn how to play with them. Well, I did, that pissed me off because I wanted 10 years in two, you know. And I thought, you know, again, and it talks about this in the third step. If I only study it hard enough, if I read this enough times, if I read all the literature, if I work hard, if I manage it well, I can get 10 in two. So, you know, I learned at 5 years the way it works. You go to meetings. You work with others, you talk to your sponsor, you don't drink, right? And at 10 years, it's the same thing. But I think, and one of the things that that I have really got to share, and I think that, I don't know, whether it, I have to tell you where I am today, because I think that it is so life-altering for me. So at, I don't know, life happens. You get sober and life is good and you don't desire a drink. I have not, since God removed that obsession, if God would not have removed that obsession, I am sure I would have drank again, because there was no power, there was no power that could keep me from that drink before I got here. No matter how hard and how many promises and what kind of commitments I had, nothing could keep me from taking that drink. But once God removed that from me, I have not had that desire to drink. And I am eternally grateful for that. My daughter has never seen me drink. I raised got a 28-year-old daughter, and she's healthy and happy and loves her mom, very much like her mom, drives me crazy. But she's never seen me take a drink. And I decided, because remember, I'm not satisfied with anything, I need to finish my education. I had an opportunity and I didn't take advantage of it, so I need to finish my education, which was a good goal. I had gotten into Department of Corrections by then, actually, as a career. I know, how about that? The irony of our recovery. And so I was working a full-time job, pretty demanding job. I was raising a child, and then I'm going to go back to school, because I am superwoman and I can do everything. And I was going to meetings, sobriety, I mean, I was connected, we were in Milledgeville, doing good. And once I went to school, it wasn't, I was just, you know, my commitment was I'm gonna go part-time, and then when I get done, I get done. Well, I went, that wasn't quick enough, so I went full-time and worked full-time and all of this. So what had to go? The meetings, right? And you know, you find that, well, I didn't drink, I don't want to drink, I'm still, you know, it was, I never lost the I never thought I didn't need it, let me say it like that. And I think that's that cunning, baffling, powerful thing that our disease does to us too. It wasn't that I didn't think I needed AA, and I certainly wasn't kicking the program aside, but I was too busy to go to meetings. I got too busy, caught up with life. And so for the next 10 years or so, it was real sporadic. You know, my ass would start falling off, and Doug and I would have this conversation of, you know, what the hell's wrong with our life? Oh my God, it's falling apart. Well, oh, gosh, we're not going to meetings. Oh, shit. So we, you know, I would go back to meetings. But then I started running into this thing. We have moved around a lot, and I will tell you this, and this has been my experience. Everywhere you go, there is AA. You can find family, you can find friends, you can find your connection everywhere you go, but it's different everywhere you go. And remember, you know, I chased that elusive dream of the alcohol, that feeling I felt at the very first time. So I wanted that old home group feeling. So I would move, and I wanted what we had that I had from my first home group. And I never could recapture that. And I didn't like that. So I got mad at it and kind of, you know, if I didn't like it, I didn't go. I'm going to fast forward to 2016. Was it 16? I think it was 16. We moved to Mableton. And again, dry. Called myself still working a program. Being batshit crazy just slips up on you. Okay. I did not realize how soberly insane I was until I got back in the rooms. And a series of events, and this really is connected to Doug's story. Doug used to tell people that I saved him. And he has his thing with that. But I believe he had the opportunity to pay me back when these series of events happened that caused him to go to a meeting up in New York with his sister. And he called me up and he said, "Oh my God," he said, "I know what's going on," like it's some big revelation. But he said, "We have got to get back to meetings." And I said, "All right, I'm in." And so I Googled it, pulled up AA, found Mableton Leland Group, and Tuesday night, we were there. And I met Mary Jean and a whole lot of other wonderful people over there. But I went and I sat and I knew I was home. I felt that feeling saying the Serenity Prayer. But like I say, I really didn't realize how crazy I had gotten until I kept going to meetings. And I was in such a place of darkness and despair in sobriety. And it can happen. And I think of, you know, of course, initially I was like, you know, my last 10 years have been shit. Well, of course, that's not right. That's how I look at things, right? It's either all or nothing. I can't, you know, and since then, of course, I've worked through that. But I asked Mary Jean, would she go to coffee with me? And she met me for coffee. And no telling what I told her, but I told her how crazy I was. And I knew that I needed to connect in. And you know what? I knew what I needed to do. 90 meetings in 90 days. I needed to work the steps, and I did. I started with step one, and I went through the steps again. I started calling people, even when the phone weighs 200 pounds. I did everything that I did when I first got sober. And it wasn't working. I was still feeling in darkness and despair. But I kept doing it. And I kept doing it. And I kept doing it. And I kept doing it. Because one thing I've learned in here is that I don't have to like it. Because there's a lot of shit I do I don't like. But my sponsor says, you know what? You don't have to like it. You just got to do it. And that's what I do. I do the things I know I need to do in spite of whether I like it or not. And I guess it took about 12 months. Interesting. It's like almost like a blue chip. But after about 12 months, something shifted. And I think, I don't know, it was like, you know, and it talks about the sunlight of the spirit. And I had early on some real vivid spiritual experiences. And I think that was one of the things that really just hooked me with this program, where I knew God was in my life. I could see the Spirit. I knew that God was working in my life. I mean, when you see recovery in other alcoholics, you see somebody get that message, there is no greater spiritual experience than watching somebody realize what their problem is and that there's a solution. But I was blocked from that. And, well, I do know why it wasn't working. Damn. Just had an epiphany. So I wasn't praying. Not genuinely praying. There was a point in my life that I thought I didn't need to pray. God knows what I need. Why do I have to ask? Right? And is that not kind of crazy? So it was when I started sincerely praying when the relief came and when the blockage left. Today, I am a part of a gratitude group. There are 7 women, and I thought about that the other day. There's something magical about the number 7. But there's 7 of us that are in a gratitude group, and every morning I wake up now thinking, what are my 3 gratitudes for the day? So that's how I start every morning. I don't get out of the bed until I say the 3rd step prayer, even though I recite it with my words screwed up, Lisa. You ever want a new car? You get fixated on a new car? And when you decide what you want, everywhere you go, you see that car. You see it in the parking lot. You see it when you pass it on the street. And it's like that with God and me. When I'm fixated on God, and I know God's there, and I'm open to that, I see God everywhere. And that's the way it is today. I see God in everything that goes on. That's the difference in my life today, and I think that's why the light has come back. I think that is why I'm feeling sober again and not just dry. The promises talk about the freedom that we will have when we get to that 9th step. And there's a lot of stuff that happened in my life that I kind of would like to shut the door on and never remember again. But it's kind of like the onion, and then peeling the layers back. It's like I've got this understanding today, and I know that in a year from now, I'll have a different understanding. In 5 years from now, I'll have a different understanding. And I think it's like that by design. I don't think there's ever an arrival point. I hope there's never an arrival. I have got to be the best person that I can be today. And I think that's the difference in striving for that. I have a lot of anger toward everything and everybody again. Some of that old stuff had come up. But today, I really am making a conscious effort to put other people first. And that's the way I want to try to live my life. And that's what that 3rd step prayer, if I can just get myself out of the way and be of service to others, then that's how I've got to be healthy and happy. And I have lost my train of thought, so I'm going to stop it there. That's all the message I can give tonight. Thank you.
think it's working again. Yeah. Whatever. Thank you, Sharon. That was awesome. Yay! Wow, she got sober 4 days before I graduated high school. I know. Can you believe that? I have asked Jen to hand out the chips.